What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Tribe of Millionaires podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Gruber, and today's guest has more letters in his name than most. DVDL, I call him. David Vanderlaan is a former attorney, recovering attorney, I like to say, an entrepreneur, an investor, a GoBundance member, and we're going to dive into his GoBundance member spotlight today. So Dave, always a pleasure, brother. How are you? Tribe listeners, I have an extremely exciting announcement for all of you. Do you want to come hang out with Cody Sanchez, David Osborne, David Green, Rich Roll, and even yours truly down in Austin, Texas? Well, let's do it. May 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, for the first time ever, GoBundance, the exclusive millionaire membership group, is opening up an event to anyone, man, woman, millionaire, or not, and we're calling it the Austin Entrepreneurial Summit. At the AES, you'll meet all those people I mentioned, plus GoBundance members on both the men's and women's side, and I'll be there hanging out the entire time. Every event I've ever attended for GoBundance has given me a disproportionate return on the money spent and the time spent to get there. And this is the biggest one that GoBundance has ever done. So if you're a member, not a member, and you're looking to supercharge the second part of your year 2024, this event in May is a great way to get that all kickstarted. Go to GoBundance.com/AES right now for early bird pricing for members and guests. And warning, the power of GoBundance events is that it holds you accountable long after you're gone to achieving whatever goals you've set. So this event will change your life. GoBundance.com/AES. I'll see you there. Let's get back to the show.
Jamie Gruber, my friend, my brother in baldness, my Sherpa out of Big Law. I'm not sure if Sherpa is only going up mountains, but I like the phrasing. Such a joy to be with you. I love talking to you, and to get to record is a special treat.
You mentioned, so you were Big Law. You had a Big Law job and you left it.
I did. So I practiced for around a decade. I actually was a summer associate at kind of a mid-sized law firm. It's kind of the thing I targeted when I was in law school. Didn't want too many hours, willing to sacrifice a little bit of salary. So that was, even that was big for most law firms, probably about 110, 120 lawyers and a couple of different. 2 weeks before I started practicing law, that merged with a firm out of Boston, creating a global firm of about 600 lawyers. And that once you get there, you're in Big Law. It's not the biggest of law firms. Some firms have a couple thousand people worldwide, but it's big enough to be Big Law. That firm was not the most financially successful law firm in the history of law firms. And so ended up merging, but really being acquired by the place where I worked for the last half decade or so, which was LockLord. So it was, I had three different law firms without ever changing jobs.
Did you ever truly, honest moment, did you ever want to be a lawyer?
Oh, sure. I don't know that I knew what it meant.
What do you mean by that? Go through that. What does that mean?
So stepping back a little bit, before I went to law school, and I had some unremarkable jobs in my 20s, but when I made the decision, I was singing professionally, and I was managing volunteers for an organization that helps the homeless here in Chicago. And while I enjoyed both of those, it wasn't creating what I would call a family supporting living. So I stepped back and said, I like to argue. I've always been good at school. I like reading and writing. So lawyering seemed like something that I would enjoy. And so armed with that knowledge, and having seen many, many episodes of Law and Order and loving a few good men, I thought I could handle the truth of actually practicing law. So I went to law school and did well and met a lot of people I liked, enjoyed the classes, enjoyed some of the practical stuff. I got to practice arguing and writing briefs and thought, okay, yes, this is for me. I really like the nuts and bolts, the blocking and tackling of it. And I got to actually practicing law and having to track my life in 6-minute increments. And it was fine. I liked the intellectual challenge of it. I met a lot of really smart, really interesting people and got to think deeply about solving really, really fascinating problems in a lot of ways. And while it was more project-based in the first couple, 3 years of my career, it was easy just to grind away at that. And I was making, you know, not huge money for people in our community necessarily, but I was making in the low six figures. And that was way more money than I had ever even really thought about making before that. And so I was willing to give away a couple thousand hours of billable time every year in exchange for that. But as I got more experienced and as I got more exposure to clients and strategic thinking, it started getting itchy for me, if that makes sense, because it hit me more and more that I was being paid to make an argument, whether I thought it was the right argument or not. And not necessarily that one side or the other was immoral, but just that I could look at a legal issue and say, this is what I think the right outcome is. And it didn't matter because my client wanted the other thing in order to win. And look, the adversary legal system is the best legal system in the history of humanity. There are all sorts of important reasons why it should exist the way it does. And everyone's entitled to their own advocate. I completely believe that. But it's like Winston Churchill's description of democracy. It's also the worst possible form of government, except everything else that's ever been tried. Or at least it was for me. Because there are people who can stand up and make an argument they don't believe in, but make it with conviction and understand that it's the right thing to do for their place in the system. It pricked my conscience continuously. And I'll tell you a story that illustrates the point.
I was going to ask you, please. Yeah, I was going to ask you, can you give an example?
What really drove this home for me was not my personal experience, but it was a conversation I had with a man who was my mentor for probably the last 5 or 6 years that I was a lawyer, and someone I dearly love. I tremendously respect him. We're still friends to this day. I don't think he's a bad guy, but his approach to lawyering was different than mine, and probably, frankly, more effective for what we needed to do. He and I were in his office talking about another case, or about to talk about another case, but he was over the moon about a result he had gotten in a case that he was working on that I wasn't. He had made an argument, but there was legislative history for a statute they were arguing about that pointed in the other direction. And he was not morally or ethically obliged to give the judge that information. That's the other lawyer's job. And it wasn't so clear that it went against him that he would have to say that he would be verboten from making the argument he made. But he was very excited because he had gotten the ruling in his favor. It was a big deal for him and his client and the firm. And I, because I don't always have the best control of my facial reactions, screwed up my face at his happiness because he and I both knew that's probably not how it should have come out from a, you know, legal fairness basis. And he looked me dead in the eye and he said to me, "Dave, my job is not to do justice." And that crushed me. And I was already thinking about getting out of the law, but that was just an absolute killer.
What would he say his job is?
His job is to advocate as best he can, zealously. That's his ethical obligation, to zealously advocate for his client's position. And trusting that the other side's attorney will also zealously advocate, then you leave it up to the fact finder, be that judge or jury, and the judge whose job it is to interpret the law to arrive at the proper outcome.
You ever see it? There's I love the movie Rounders. Did you ever see Rounders?
Oh, not in a very long time.
Love that movie. Poker movie. Matt Damon, Ed Norton. Oh, God, I love that movie. I gotta go watch it. But there's a line in there about, I forget what he says. He goes, "It's like this one poker player said, it's immoral to let a sucker keep his money. It feels a bit like..." Feels a bit like his perception on the law is similar.
Maybe. I think that you don't want to assume that the lawyer on the other side is a sucker, but no one's unhappy if your adversary is less skilled than you are.
That's fair. We're going to talk about how you left and the next phase of life and everything. But I've always found that lawyers, doctors, people that have to spend years and years in some form of education and or practice / residency, you know, you call it what you want. I'm sure there's other professions I'm not thinking of. I mean, you have a deeply embedded identity as that. You've spent time, money, hours. There's even a social construct that really supports the fact like, wow, that's a lawyer. That's a doctor, like top of the socioeconomic ladder, right? And now you're talking about giving it all up. Was it harder to give up the income or harder to give up the identity?
As between the two, I think it was harder to give up the income. The identity, I think, is something I had sloughed off years before, in all honesty. When I decided that I didn't want to be a lawyer anymore and I started looking for what the right off-ramp would be. So just to give a little bit of time frame, I graduated from law school in 2011, started practicing the fall of 2011. By 2015 and early 2016, I was already starting to think about, okay, what am I going to do next? Will I become a judge? Because that is at least an impartial arbiter of what the law, what the legal outcome really should be. And then how will I supplement my income? Because at that point, if I were to go from a mid-level big firm associate to a state court judge, that would have been about a 50% pay cut. So how could I supplement? That's what led me to Bigger Pockets, which led me to Rich Dad, Poor Dad, which ultimately, you know, that being in those circles led me to be interested in GoBundance. And that's one of the reasons why you and I are talking today.
Yeah.
So I would say I sloughed off that lawyerly identity probably half a decade before I left. But even that sense of shifting identities is something that I dealt with when I became a lawyer, because, and we haven't talked about this yet, except for me alluding to singing professionally.
I wrote it down.
I'm a musician by training and temperament. I've been singing since I could talk. And my parents met singing in a choir in Chicago. I've always sung in choirs. My bachelor's degree is in vocal performance. So the biggest identity shift of my life, at least to that point, was shifting from musician to attorney. And having done that once, I think it was much easier for me to shift away from attorney to guy who doesn't really know what he's going to do after he's a lawyer, to then leaving the law and shifting into entrepreneur, visionary COO for the business I now run with my wife.
That's why I was asking if you truly ever wanted to be a lawyer. You come from a more of an artistic background. You know, you alluded to, you said it, we'll talk about the singing. We're going to get into it. I might even have you sing if you, that's one of the card game questions actually is sing a song, but I didn't pull that one up.
I'd give you that one for free, Jamie. I'm not shy about singing.
We might have to do it. That'll be the trailer for this episode too. So
I love it.
But singing professionally does not, the type of brain, the type of mind, the type of person that sings and is bold enough and confident enough to go out there and do that professionally, no matter if you're making money or not, isn't the person in my mind that becomes an attorney. It feels like attorney was like a practical settlement for you at that phase in your life. That's what it feels like. That's why I wonder if you were ever truly wanted to be an attorney. So I guess the question I'm wondering is, if you had to go back and do it all again, would you still pursue that path? And if not, what would you do differently knowing what you know now?
It's a fascinating question. And
Is it?
Yes, it is. You're good at your job. And I appreciate that about you. I feel like
this is where Dave gets more vocabulary on me. Go for it.
Exactly the right amount of people say that to you on this pod. Like, yeah, that's a great question. Jamie, you ask really good questions. And they say it too because it's true. You're very, very good at this. And I hope that me giving you this extended compliment has bought me enough time to actually think of a good answer to your question.
I was thinking, this is filibustering.
You want to talk about a lawyerly skill. It's saying a bunch of words while you think about the thing you really want to say. I don't know that I would, because it was such a tremendous investment of time and money. It's funny. Joy is my wife that you know, but the audience doesn't necessarily. She was just looking at the latest student loan bill, and you know, we were kind of pumping our fists because now we owe fewer than $70,000 left on my law school loans that I haven't used in a couple of years. And I went through a lot of emotional stress in my legal life. There were times, and you understand this as someone who walked away from a career he didn't necessarily love. Sunday afternoons and Sunday evenings got really, really hard, where I would just be inconsolable, absolutely inconsolable. And I don't know that suicidal is the right word. And there were moments, more than a few, when I would be putting away dishes and I would have a steak knife in my hand and I would just hold it for a beat longer than I needed to put it away. And I would have to remind myself of a promise I made to myself again in those mid-20-teens that I would not die a lawyer. Like, I said that to myself a lot. And that's not an emotionally healthy place to be, is my point. So I would not want to put myself through all of that again. With that said, because I have the skill set to argue both sides of a question,
yeah,
I acquired skills through my legal training, through my legal practice, that are absolutely applicable to what I'm doing now. And it's beyond being able to read through a contract and fly spec it in a way that a layperson can't. It is that level of critical thinking, of being able to see both sides and take another person's perspective. I got a lot of reps with that through 3 years in law school and 10 years in legal practice that I don't know that I necessarily would have gotten doing something else. And the other thing I'll say about that is at 27, 28, when I went to law school, I wasn't prepared for entrepreneurship. I wasn't prepared for it, not just from a skill set perspective, but I also think emotionally, I could not have dealt with the level of having to iterate through failure that's required to succeed when you're running your own business. And I'm much more prepared for that now in my 40s.
Will you, when you're 90, or even today, is there a part of you, if God, you just got the worst news, is there any part of you that would regret not fully seeing through what a music career could have been for you?
But I think the answer is no. I think the answer is ultimately no.
How can you think an answer is no to something like that?
Yes
or is it no?
I feel in my 90-year-old heart and gut that the answer is no, but I'm rationing my way through it. Music is, it's a tough thing to see through because you need to be, to really succeed, to have outsized, life-changing, generational wealth kind of success, you need to be in the 99th percentile, probably higher than that, of musical skill. And you need to be preposterously physically attractive. And I'm a nice looking dude, but I'm not Ricky Martin, which is a weird 90s pull, but you and I are about the same age. And even for people like that, even for people who are the highest of high level talent and model level Zoolander, ridiculously good looking, they probably need a lucky break to make it. They need to be dating the studio executive's daughter at the right point in their career, or they need to be on stage when the right A&R person saw them. And it's a little bit different now because the internet has made it easier to reach an audience directly. But that sort of reach didn't exist in my 20s, at least not to the level it does now.
Why is the singing career limited to your 20s? I have two questions off of this, but let me start with that. Why is your singing career limited to your 20s?
So I have a pet theory called singer shelf life. I think that most singers, if they're going to be credible performers, are going to do that while they're really young. Now, part of this has to do, again, with the insane physical attractiveness, but the people who are really successful singing in middle age and later are the people typically who are already successful in their 20s. You know, Sinatra was packing people into arenas into his 70s because he was the voice when he was in his 20s and 30s. And I'm sure we could come up with counterexamples, but I think that largely that's the pattern. And so I was 27 and I was singing at weddings and I was having a great time and I was making $30,000 a year. But even for a wedding singer, for a wedding musician, the guy who owned that company was at that point probably in his 50s. He was a saxophone player. He could play sax with the band and, you know, announce things and call tunes for another couple decades. And he has. He's still got the company. He's doing incredibly well. But to be up there, there's only so long that you can be fronting a band and singing the pop hit of the day without looking ridiculous.
Okay. Being a lawyer gave you a certain set of skills that have been very relevant for you as an entrepreneur. Your statement, correct?
Yes.
Has being a lawyer also narrowed your mind and destroyed your ability to be creative?
No.
How do you know that?
I don't know that, Jamie, but you, the last time I equivocated on something, you told me I needed to give you a yes or no. So that's what I was trying to do.
Well, hit me because I feel the opposite. I think you may not realize how much it has sapped it from you, but go for it.
So you may well be right. And
no, I am right. That's not a may well, but I want to hear your logic and then I'm going to
Jamie, you're absolutely right. Let me tell you why you're wrong. There is more creativity in being a lawyer than you would expect because you have legal precedent. It's a set of case law, and you need to comb through and decide which of these cases really applies, which doesn't. You need to figure out why the ones that go against you don't. And then you also have a set of facts. Some facts are good in your case, some facts are bad, depending on the outcome you're trying to get. it is the advocate's job. Now, by the way, there are lots of different kinds of lawyers. I was a litigator, and so I'm talking from a litigator's perspective. The creativity comes in, how do I apply the precedents I've chosen? There's creativity in choosing them too, to the facts I've chosen, and there's creativity in choosing the facts you mix into this, and create a persuasive argument out of all of that. And there's also just creativity in, how do I phrase this appropriately? How do I make it not milquetoast in the way I write it? I don't want it to be bland. I want it to be interesting to the judge, because the judge is a person and I want him or her to continue reading and continue to be compelled by it. So I want to craft a compelling narrative, but I don't want to overstate my argument. I don't want to be so bombastic in what I say that whoever's reading it, the judge in most cases will say, that can't possibly be right. Dave's gotten way out over his skis. I'm now less inclined to believe him. He's actually lost some credibility with me because he's argued too vociferously on this particular point. So finding the right phrasing, finding the right precedent, finding the right sets of facts, and then how you put all that together, there's a great deal of creativity within, admittedly, some relatively strict constraints. But anticipating an argument you might make next, I think there's a lot of great creativity that come from being constrained too. If you look at, take music for another example, because I'm, again, a musician by training and temperament, we are, as musicians, typically constrained by a 12-tone chromatic scale and the typical chord progressions that are pleasing to the Western ear. And we can get into deep weeds of music theory, but I can already see by your eyes that maybe you're already a little bored. So we won't do that. But there are real constraints. Sorry to the listeners for calling out Jimmy.
No, you're good. I'm finding something that I'm going to reply with. Go for it.
But I'm right about this, and he's wrong. Within the constraints of what is pleasing to the Western ear, you have to get creative with things like melody and occasionally subverting expectations by, okay, every pop song has 1-4-5-1. Well, maybe what if I did 1-4-6-5-1? That's not usually what happens here. And I'm going to, to go to sexy back, I'm going to take it to the bridge at a place where you don't necessarily expect. But it's living with meeting expectations for long enough that the subversion is a surprise and it's all still pleasing. That's creativity within constraints in what is typically seen as a more creative pursuit than being an attorney.
Mr. Vanderlaan, that is a lucid, well thought out, intelligent statement.
Thank you, sir. Why do I think there's a butt coming?
Overruled. I wonder if you're watching this, do you get the movie reference? Do you get the movie reference?
I don't think I do.
Mr. Gambini, that is a lucid, well thought out, reasonable objection. Thank you, Judge. Overruled. My cousin, Vinny, come on.
As someone who in his pre-law life enjoyed law-based entertainment, I am somewhat ashamed to say I have never seen the film.
Why don't you, a very quick answer, why don't you enjoy it in your post-law life?
Because I've become a pedant for all of the things that they do that isn't real lawyering.
What is a pedant?
A pedant is someone who is unduly picky in the details.
Got it. Okay. Okay. When you were a kid, were you a pedant in anything?
Oh, damn near everything, Jamie. I've been this way my whole life. I'm very detail oriented, and I think that serves me well in a lot of ways. What I've needed to learn as I've matured is not to always point out to everyone when they have missed the boat in a particular detail.
Yeah, especially vocabularily, which isn't even a word. Vocabularily.
It can be now.
It can be now. Here's what I submit to you, counselor, that you had a passion for what you did. The problem was the money wasn't where you wanted it to be. So yeah, of course you construct these things. And I did the same thing. I wanted to be a NFL broadcaster. It's like, I don't want to go here and do that. And there's a shelf life to that, whatever. Family, travel is not the best lifestyle for my family. Okay, I could tell myself that. But you had a passion for this art. You're going to sing later, right? Like teaser, you're going to sing. We're going to make you sing.
Very exciting.
You have a true passion for this, but the replies that you're giving are measured. They are very narrow. And what I mean by narrow is it's like, what if you had a wedding singing business that made 150 grand for you a year? Does that sound more interesting? In other words, like you're narrowed in on like, I've got to be this one, this good looking young person. And two, you're talking success in Sinatra terms, right? Like success is happiness. It's happiness. Like there's plenty of, I follow this guy, Gino the Ghost on Instagram. He's got a couple Emmys or whatever as a producer, done some rapping or whatever. He makes $100,000 a year, something like that, right? He makes a nice living. He's got a few awards to his name or whatever. He's loving his life because he's able to do what he loves and make some money doing it and all of that. Like what I heard from you was a very like, well, unless it is Bette Midler, Vegas act for 30 years where I get this massive contract, unless it's that, then there isn't success in me being in that industry. And I think that that massive dichotomy between I can make $130,000 a year and be happy in the business of music versus no, success means I got to be making $6 million a year and be an absolute icon. I think you settling on lawyerhood, another word of mine, lawyerhood is potentially what sapped you of the ability to see this over here, this idea of I could be happy in this industry from this, well, success is only one thing. What say you, counselor? The key to life, it isn't money. It's happiness. And when you measure how happy you are, you actually become even more happy. Our friends at GoBundance, the Tribe of Millionaires, use a very specific tool to measure their happiness. It's called the Life Happiness Index, and you can have it too. Go over to GoBundance.com/LHI and take your Life Happiness Index assessment. You'll rate yourself in multiple categories on exactly how happy you are and get a custom output for you specifically that you can use in developing whatever goals you have for your life. GoBundance is the tribe of healthy, wealthy, generous people who choose to live epic lives. And the tool GoBundance members use at the base of all of that is the Life Happiness Index. Get out there and grab life big.
That is a totally reasonable argument to make.
Such a lawyer.
And I have two responses. The first is, wait until you see me in my redheaded wig and I start singing God is Watching Us from a Distance, then I'm really going to look like Bette Midler to you.
I like that. Okay.
That may have to wait until a live event.
Or it could be more private. That kind of sexy to me, but can continue.
That's something you're going to need to lie down on a couch and talk to a professional about. The second thing, and this more directly addresses your point, but it's also a lesson in legal argumentation. Because one thing a skilled lawyer will do is find a way to reject the premise. And I reject this premise in your logic, which is that artistic happiness, musical happiness, requires making any money from it whatsoever. This is actually a point that I failed to make earlier, but it allows me to come back to it.
I like this.
I spend a fair amount of my time making music now. Not as much as I'd like to, candidly, but I sing in my church choir. That's a couple hundred hours a year of volunteerism. I'm privileged to sing in a choir that has on its heaviest days 100 people in it, some of whom are current and former pros. There's also a smaller chamber choir, which is really, really good. And I'm blessed to occasionally get to compose music that I sing alone in worship. I've written for small ensembles and I've written some music for our choir. That is a tremendously satisfying outlet for my musical creativity. It's probably not as musically satisfying as making music all day full time. I completely acknowledge that. But this notion of I have a job or a business in this art, or I can't be happy artistically at all, I think is a false dichotomy.
That's a great, great answer. You win the point. You win like 15 love. 15 love Vanderlaan. That's a great point.
I'm just imagining hitting a tennis ball at a judge and I feel like I've just been held in contempt.
No, I'm serious. I think that is a really fair point. You're right. Like, you know, having a passion for it. Like that was one of the things that felt heavy about me being an NFL broadcaster. I did a radio show. I do NFL picks. It was when I was like 16 locally. Some DJ gave me a chance at that, which was so cool, right? I had my own little segment on Fridays to do picks.
Yeah.
And it honestly, like, I didn't give a shit about the Packers and the Buccaneers score, like what they were going to do, right? Like, I knew what I liked about football and enjoyed about it. And all of a sudden, it started to feel heavy, like work, like a job. So, yeah, I'll concede that point. The fact that if you've got music in your life and that gives you fulfillment and happiness, then yeah, it doesn't have to be a money-making endeavor. So, fair.
Yeah, and that's a really important point you're making too. And it's something I learned when I was singing full time. Anything you do, no matter how much you have a passion for the art or the science of it, sometimes it's going to feel like work. Some days it's going to feel like work. Some tasks are going to be the ones that you don't love to do. And yes, as you grow a business, you can delegate and elevate and get away from people. But there's, you'd be really hard pressed to find anything that anyone's going to do where they rocket out of bed and every single day they love every moment of everything about their occupation. And so that really opened my eyes and said, I need to pick my pain.
Yeah, makes sense. Makes perfect sense. Let's move down the road a bit on this. Your wife, Joya, starts Nourish House Calls. She is, I always get this wrong. She's a nurse practitioner, correct?
You got it right. Congratulations.
I got LPN. There's all these different RN. She's a nurse practitioner.
Yeah, I'll walk you through a bit of the story. So we got married in 2006. And we like to joke that every 3 to 7 years, we'll just blow up our lives because we got a little bored. So we get married in 2006, 2008. At this point, Joya was a registered nurse. She was working on the floor at Northwestern Memorial Hospital. Very good at her job. She decided she wanted more from her life. And so she went back to get her master's in nursing. She started in the spring of 2008. Right around that time, I said, I'm going to law school. I started law school in the fall of 2008. And so we went into full bunker mode for the next 3 years. She was working full-time and going to school part-time. I was going to school part-time. And for the first couple of years of school, still singing on the weekends. So our date night would be like Tuesday afternoon. And then in 2011, on a Friday, I graduated from law school. And on Saturday, she graduated with her master's in nursing.
Wow.
Then she took her boards over the summer. I took the bar over the summer. And on August 30th, our oldest daughter was born. It was a busy year. She went to work for a pain management clinic here in suburban Chicago, doing some pain management, some functional medicine, which is really what she's passionate about, while I was practicing law. Fast forward to 2017 or so, she was not in love with that job anymore. She'd never wanted to hang out her own shingle. She'd resisted the idea, but was looking for a practice that would let her practice functional medicine full time and treat her and patients the way she wanted herself and patients to be treated. Couldn't find anybody that was doing that was hiring. And so finally she bit the bullet. And in February of 2018, she started Nourish House Calls, which is a functional medicine house call practice. She was running at the time. Now we run it together here in the western suburbs of Chicago. At that point, the idea was just for her to have something to do. And it would, I mean, more than that, she wanted to help people. She wanted to help patients. But she was comfortable part-time. It will grow as it grows, you know, through word of mouth and some provider referrals. And we've been blessed that it grew nicely in the first few years with just that. Yeah, so she's excellent at her job. And what that allowed me to do several years later was take a look around at my life, because I was helping her with this business. We had another business at the time that we've since shuttered. And a very wise man who's on the other side of the screen said to me, "What could you do for those businesses if you took 6 months away from being a lawyer? You know you want to quit, but don't think of it as leaving forever. Think of it as a 6-month sabbatical. What can you do for those businesses?" And I said, "I could do a hell of a lot. Do you have the money to walk away for 6 months? "Yes, I do." "What's the worst thing that would happen if everything goes to zero?" "Well, I could always go back and be a lawyer. It'd be unpleasant, but I could get a job." "Then what's stopping you?" So that was October of 2021. I had gone to Ann Arbor to see a Michigan Northwestern football game. And the next day I had lunch with you, Jamie, and you walked me through that very generously. And I came home on fire and a little bit scared, because not the identity shift at all, but just here we are blowing up our lives again. And I presented that to Joya after I got home mid-October. And she said, "Give me to Thanksgiving. Let me chew on this. We can keep talking about it, but I really just need to process the notion." And it really was a big change for her. And the identity shift was more hers than mine, even, because she was going from, "I have a business where I can help people, but there's no real pressure to make money." At this point, I was getting toward mid six figures with the law firm and some investments. And so the income from Nourish was gravy. And now we were going to make that the financial driver of our family's success. And so she needed to process that, and understandably so. And we were coming up on our 15th anniversary. And we went away for a long weekend in Albuquerque, New Mexico, of all places.
It's a traditional place for most couples to go on their anniversary.
Well, you know me, I love traditional anniversary getaways. And we were sitting at this lovely farm-to-table kind of restaurant. And she looked at me, and I may well start crying here on camera, which I only half expected. And she said, "I'm in. Go for it." And in that moment, I wept like a child. Like, it was just all of the pressure that had built up in me over a decade of legal practice and 5-6 years of really hating it just released in that moment. It was one of the really beautiful things in what has been a beautiful marriage over these last 17 years. So that she gave me a great gift in that and put a tremendous amount of trust in me to bring value to the business and help grow it. And so that's what I've done since the end of January 2022. I gave my notice on January 3rd because we were going to wait until I got my bonus. And fortunately, it was the biggest bonus I had ever gotten in my career. And so I've spent the last year and a half now working on helping Nourish House Calls grow and getting some other things in order with our family too, as far as LP positions and passive income and arranging our retirement accounts so they're growing a little faster under my direction as opposed to a 401k custodians. But Nourish is my big focus. I'm so excited and so privileged to have my job go from arguing side of a case whether I think it's the right one or not to now at a high level. My job is to introduce the world to my wife and her genius and have her help the world get healthy. That's a cool job. I'm very excited about that. And to what we were talking about earlier, there are some moments when it feels like work. I don't love every aspect of it, but the big picture of it is so exciting and so motivating. And I'm so thrilled to be partnering with her and doing what I think is really good work in the world. Yeah, it's just an absolute blessing.
You're also very good at it. So that helps. You're really
thank
really
you. Thank
of
you.
Of course. When's your anniversary, by the way?
November 4th, 2006. So just as of this recording, just a couple weeks after.
Well, congratulations. And you didn't make it to Thanksgiving.
No. She gave me the answer early, which was I was happy to not have to twist in the wind for another few weeks.
Yeah. Hell of a sabbatical. 6 months extends a long time. This is the longest 6 month sabbatical I've ever seen, I can tell you.
Well, you know, I'm trying the Ed Milet method of, you know, every 6 months I live a year and a half.
That's a great, great reference. I love that. We're going to go to the member questions, but I want to tie up a little bit on Nourish real quick. Great business. I had Joya on the podcast. That episode will come out and we get into, I mean, everything from medical conspiracy through just like really tactical, practical, functional medicine, regenerative medicine principles, which it was, I told you, like, I go into it like, yeah, this will be interesting, but it was really, really good. So I'm excited about releasing that episode. Not that I'm not with this, but the wife was good. So
as between the two of us, she is better looking, more charming, has a more valuable skill set. I know that I outkick my coverage and I'm proud of it.
There you go. Good for you. Where is Nourish licensed? Do you know that offhand?
I do. Right now, we are licensed in Illinois, Florida, New Hampshire, and Vermont. That is an unusual state mix. We're in Illinois, obviously, but that's come about through some partnerships and other opportunities we've had. Some have worked, some have not. Vermont, actually, and I don't know when this is exactly dropping. That came about because we are providing IVs at the event in Stowe at the end of January, the GoBundance Winter Mastermind. So we're very, very excited about doing that. So that's the Vermont angle. We are working on getting Joya licensed in this one. I'm going to try to do from memory, Washington, Oregon, California, Arizona, Texas, Pennsylvania.
Oh, I don't remember Pennsylvania. Okay, gotcha. The other ones I remember.
I think we're going to have her licensed there by the end of Q1 2024.
Amazing.
Or very shortly thereafter. And that's going to open up more possibilities for us to help more people.
I love it, man. I love it. NourishHouseCalls.com, correct?
Yes, sir.
NourishHouseCalls.com. All right, let's dive into some of these GoBundance member questions. So we have six pillars in GoBundance: bucket list adventure, horizontal income, age-defying health, genuine contribution, authentic relationships, and extreme accountability. In which of those six are you crushing it?
I feel like I'm crushing it in contribution, genuine contribution. Part of that is what we talked about before. I spend, it really is a couple hundred hours a year, donating my time and musical skill to my church. And I think that if everyone could find something they really love, that they do really well, and find a way to give that away, that is the most wonderful way to genuinely contribute to society, because you're going to feel great about it. You'll be operating in your zone of genius, and there's always someone that can be helped by the thing that you do best. The other thing that I do is we tithe. So I'm a person of Christian faith, and one of the ways we live that out of spiritual discipline is every dollar that comes in, we've got a separate account for charitable contribution, and 10 cents of every dollar goes into that account. And we find ways to donate that, whether it's to church or Christian education or other sorts of charitable endeavors.
Amazing. And which of those pillars could you use more support and accountability?
Right now, I think it's bucket list adventures. Part of that is a function of where we are in our business lives. Nourish is at a point where it really requires full attention from me and from Joya. We're looking to grow, and in that, I think we'll be able to free up some more time. But it just requires a lot of our attention right now. The other thing is life stage. We haven't talked about kids at all, but I have a 12-year-old, one of them, and 10-year-old twins. My 12-year-old is on the autism spectrum, high functioning. My twin son has ADHD and intermittent explosive disorder. I share that just to say parenting is more challenging for us than it is for the average person. And there's a little bit more risk when we travel adventurously, or if we try to bite off more than we could chew. And so one of the things I'm trying to balance in my life right now is, one, how to mitigate that risk, but two, just how to accept it and live with it, because we've got 6 summers left with everybody in the house. And I don't want my fear, because let's call it what it is, of an expensive, lengthy vacation being ruined or marred in part by some negative behavior, to keep me from showing my children the world. So I'm still working through that. So anybody who's got support or accountability, not so much of ideas for places I could go, because I can do that, but help I could get working through that and figuring out how to balance all of those parts of my emotional life.
Where are authentic relationships on the spectrum? And I ask because you enjoy, I've been around you a nice weekend in Chicago. We spent time both, you know, kind of professionally and personally together. There's a lot of passion, a lot of joy between the two. You're connected. It's easily viewable. There's no act. There's no nothing. You two are very simpatico, whatever.
I think they both were.
What being the parent of a child with autism or on the spectrum and a child with ADHD and intermittent explosive disorder, how does that play on your relationship?
We don't have the 3 hours it would take for me to unpack that fully. I feel good about where I am in authentic relationships, in no small part because of the quality of my marriage. Let's start there. The divorce rate for parents of children with autism is high. I forget exactly what the number is, as is the divorce rate for parents of twins. I don't know if there's a number for the confluence, but that's where we are. I'd imagine it's gnarly. So to have a healthy and thriving and passionate and joyful marriage is a tremendous blessing, and something that we work at in a way that doesn't feel like work. With my kids, I feel well bonded to all of them, and it's a different kind of relationship. And you're a father of multiple children. You also know that, neuroatypicality aside, you end up having a different kind of relationship with each of your children, because they're ultimately different people from one 100%.
Another. 100%.
So I don't think I'm a perfect father. I think I'm doing my best. I feel good about my fathering much of the time, and I'm working to get better. So I rank authentic relationships relatively high there, and I'd be lying if I said there wasn't some grief around it. And I grieve the loss of the kind of fatherhood that I thought that I would have before these diagnoses. And it doesn't mean that there aren't wonderful moments. And they are people of absolute worth. They are children created in the image of God, and I love them deeply. And sometimes they're just really mean to me. And I know that that's true for all children and people going through puberty. But man, the confluence of puberty hormones with autism that expresses itself in a way where, like, the main symptom is responding to disappointment with cruelty, that's hard. And it puts a strain on the relationship. And frankly, I think the strain is more on Joya than it is on me. Well, that dynamic shifted too. You want to talk about shifting identities? It just as a little bit of an aside, for the first 9 years of our oldest daughter's life, her name is Sophie, Joya was there with her. She was home most of the time. She was in the trenches for good and for ill. And so she got the highest highs and she got the absolute lowest lows. That shifted. Joya is busy with patients. I am the flex parent. And so if somebody forgets something that they need driven to school, I'm your Huckleberry. If they need to be driven to camp or a practice or whatever, I'm the guy doing that. If they're having an absolute meltdown and using all sorts of language that I'm not going to use on a family podcast to describe their parents and their life, I'm the guy that wears that now. So there is strain from that. With that said, I'm so incredibly blessed for having the last year and a half, because I've seen more of my children in the last year and a half than I had in the previous, maybe the whole decade. I get to see them every, I'm home when they get home from school. And that's incredible, because on an average day, I was gone 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. And now do I get a little bit less work done on the business than I would if I had an office somewhere else? Yeah, probably. Could we grow a little faster, a little better if it had that kind of attention from me? Yes. And I'm not willing to make that sacrifice. I will be here for my children's childhood, and I'll go back to a lawyer story, and then we'll get to the next question. This was the other thing, and another conversation I had with this same mentor. This was during COVID, but we had been locked down and away for a while. So this was probably late 2020 that I was talking to him. And we had gone from everybody go to the office every day, and you're eating dinner there a lot of nights, just that's the nature of the gig. Two, you're working from home and you are around your children. His kids are a little older than mine. He's got two in college now, and I think one in high school. But at this point, they were, you know, I think his oldest daughter was late high school. And we were talking about the difference in our lives and having a little more flexibility and being present with our kids and how that was nice. And I asked him, what was he thinking about going back to practicing law the old way, where he was going to be in the office? Because at some point COVID was going to end and people were going to go back to the office. And there's still a little bit of flex time there, of course. And how he responded was, I missed part of my children's childhood. I'm damn sure not going to miss the rest of it.
That was heavy. I appreciate you saying that though. But no, I completely get that. I could feel you coming through the screen right now. So, wow, man. Amazing. Thank you for sharing that story. Where in your life are you potentially flirting with this? I don't know how to segue to this question. Where in your life are you potentially flirting with disaster?
Not even potentially. It's a full flirtation for us. Right now, from a patient care perspective, Nourish House Calls is Joya Vanderlaan. And so if, God forbid, something were to happen to Joya, that would be tragic on any number of levels, of course, but our business would run to zero. And so one of the things I'm actively working on is making this more of a sustainable business that is not entirely dependent on the force of personality of my beautiful wife. We're working on self-implementing EOS right now. We are working on growing the business to the point where I think within the next 12 months, we will hire another nurse practitioner to handle increased patient load. And the goal over the next handful of years is to get to 3 to maybe 7 NPs who are doing the same sorts of thing that Joya is doing, just for different patients within the practice, and have some nurses who can give IVs as well. And at that point, we can step out of the business, whether that, you know, and hopefully that's not because Joya has died, you know, but we can go and travel and the business can sustain on its own. Or if we ever think about selling, now it's a saleable asset. Sellable asset? Saleable asset? Now I'm confused about grammar.
They both work for me.
Well, good. And it's so important for me to say things that work for you on your podcast, as it should be. Well, I'll say one other thing about that.
Sure.
I'm so grateful for GoBundance, because as I think about that happening, and mercifully, I don't think about it that much. If the worst would happen and the business would run to zero and I would be alone raising three kids, two of them with special needs, I have a half dozen people that I could think of off the top of my head that I would call and say, hey, here's my situation. I need some income. Do you have something that I could do in your business for your business? I just need to raise the floor. Or could you connect me to somebody? And I don't know that any of those people would have something immediately, but I have no doubt that they would drop whatever they are doing and move heaven and earth to get me in a situation where I could support my family. And to have that community and the confidence that comes with that is enormous.
I've said my relational equity is the best equity I have. And I get that from GoBundance. In other words, if everything went south on me, yeah, I mean, I have to, like you, you have to figure it out. You got to, you know, pull yourself up. But the ability to go inside to a group of people that you, you know, you bond and grow and whatever with. And to your point, not saying like you will help me, but man, like, what can you do? How can you help me out here? And whether it's them or a connection or two connections away, I mean, I've seen it happen a ton of times already, you know, in different, in a much smaller, less catastrophic way for me. So, man, that means a lot. I appreciate you talking through that. And this might go into the next question. You tell me, but in what specific way has GoBundance impacted your life?
I'll confess I've been very excited about answering this question for a very long time.
Hit so me.
Lots of guys, when this question is posed, talk about the value of GoBundance in their professional business life. And I could give you examples. There are absolutely things we do in Nourish that I can trace directly back to conversations I've had, advice I've been given from guys in GoBundance. And that's been terrific. And I appreciate that. I want to go a little different direction with this. My first GoBundance event was in Dallas in the fall of 2022. The keynote speaker was now GoBro and former podcast guest, the great Trav Bell. This was his first introduction to GoBundance. And if you have not had the Trav Bell experience, anybody out there in podcast land, run, don't walk. He is charismatic and funny and such a gifted storyteller and does a great job at packaging large, complex ideas and putting them in a simplified framework. He's really, really good. He's the bucket list guy for people that don't know. And without giving away too much of the Trav Bell experience, there is a point during which he will have everyone do a kind of a time-bound exercise where you are encouraged is not strong enough a word. Forced probably is better to take affirmative real action, a real step toward achieving something on your bucket list. And I did that for a couple of years prior to that. I had been talking to a dear friend of mine here in Chicago. He's a buddy of mine from church, who's another really well-read guy, about going through all of the great books of the Western canon. The University of Chicago has a curriculum called the Core Curriculum, where you read, you know, everything from things in from Greek antiquity up to, you know, great American novels. And I texted him. His name is Blue. I was like, Blue, we're going to do this. Let's pick a date. Let's pick a book to read and let's get started. And we did. So for the last year, I have steeped myself in Greek history from Herodotus and Plato and Sophocles, and we read Dostoevsky. And there's a group of, I think it's five guys, who will get together every month or so and have a nice dinner and wine and talk about these great books and these huge ideas. It's a wonderful way to pause in the go, go, go of parenting and being a good husband and building a business. And there's always activity, and you just step back. And it's not just stepping back to work on the business, which is obviously important to do. It's stepping back to look at life as a whole and Western history as a whole and say, what in this book can I really apply to my existence now? And that's just been tremendously fun. So thank you, Trav, and thank you, GoBundance, for getting me to read books that educated men ought to have read.
That's incredible. I never actually partook in his exercises, and I need to. It was a great podcast. He's got a great accent too, but
the accent's killer.
It's funny. That's the one. I'm sorry.
Can you indulge me one quick other Trav Bell story?
Please,
it'll be brief.
Please, go for it. Yeah.
So same event. This was as publicly embarrassed as I've been in a very long time. So we're getting toward the end of, and Trav does a two-part experience. This is getting toward the end of part two. We're all standing in a circle and he's pacing around almost feral, you know, just firing us up. And at one point, Trav walks over toward the part of the room where I am, and he walks out with his arm extended and a closed fist out. Now, Jamie, if a man walked toward you, looked you in the eye, and extended his fist, what would you do?
Bump.
Pound him. Yeah. It's the international sign for give me a pound.
Yeah.
So I, being the friendly gentleman I am, reached out my hand and I gave Trav Bell a fist pound. And for the next 15 seconds, but what felt like 7.5 years, he expressed shock and almost dismay at what had happened. He had no idea that that was coming. It's not what he expected. And he didn't mock me, but he also, like, it was a public show of him not expecting that. And look, he probably saved, like he, it was fine and it was amusing, but I was like, I wanted to crawl into a shell of myself.
What was he expecting?
I have no idea. To this day, I don't know. Trav, if you're out there, if you're listening, call me and tell me what happened, because I have puzzled over it for the last year.
That's hilarious. I don't know what else you would do. Grab
I don't know either.
That's strange. Yeah. If you find out, let me know, please.
I will.
What's one piece of advice you would give to a new or prospective member of a GoBundance community?
Show up and add value is a common answer, and it's common because it's the right one, but also be vulnerable. Lead with vulnerability, not because you are expressing a need that you want people to fill, but because it's the right thing to do in this community, and it encourages other people to be vulnerable. And if you want to build the sorts of relationships that the guys who have been here a while have with each other, vulnerability is the way.
No, I completely agree. Without it, I don't know how you get any value. You know, without going deep, if you're just going to be surface level, I don't know how you truly extract value. Like, a one sheet is only as good as your ability to say, hey, this is the real stuff right now. You know? So
I think it's exactly right.
Makes perfect sense. Get your pipes ready. We're going to get a little song before the end of it, but I'm going to first ask you a question from the GoBundance card game, Two of Diamonds. What is something that is really popular right now, but in 5 years, everyone will look back on and be embarrassed by?
How controversial do you want me to get here?
I don't care. Go controversy, full on controversy.
I don't know if it's going to be in 5 years, but I think history will not look kindly on allowing school-age children to decide their gender and then giving them irreversible surgery to align with what they've said.
Doesn't it feel like, remember those old VH1, like, you know, remember the 90s, remember the 80s, where they have people come on and like, this, we were wearing this stuff? Like, whoa, were we crazy? How stupid that looked. I could see that VH1 sort of track 5 years, 10, whatever it is, playing on the same thing. And it's not, look, for me, it's not like some people as adults don't feel they identify or want to dress a certain way. Like, I really don't care. My heart, I'm sort of agnostic, if that's the word. Like, do what you want to do. Live your life. Just don't bother me. Right? That's kind of my general way of looking at it. I have my feelings. I have my morals. I have my standards. I have my guide, my internal guidance. But that movement is jumping the shark the moment that it wants the kids. Right? The whole movement, as soon as it's saying, no, kids should be extended this care without parental intervention, without parental discussion, all of that. Like, yes, you need to sign this slip for a field trip for liability purposes, but mutilate your kid and you shouldn't know about it because they have those rights. I couldn't agree more. You look like you want to say something.
No, I just agree with that. Them being a minor does change the calculus.
I was going to go also with the bruh, no cap, Gen Z talk. Like, I think that's going to look stupid in 5 years too.
I think that sort of thing, does it go in 5 year cycles or does it really just kind of live on with the generation? I will tell you that I have started saying no cap around my kids because it's the thing they understand.
Everyone has their thing. My parents said they used to use boss. Did you ever hear that from your parents?
Oh, sure. That's a very 60s thing, right?
Right. That's boss. And we had what? Cool. There was cool. Fat for a while. Dope. That all came from our thing. So there's you're right. There is sort of that thing. Baldness. You think baldness looks bad in 5 years? It's very popular right now.
Good God. I hope not. This is the only attractive option I have.
Same. For some of us, it's going to have to be, whether it's good or bad, who knows? So, all right. Are you a jukebox? Do I get to pick it?
I think within reasonable limits. Yeah,
like I go Nothing But a G Thing by Dr. Dre and Snoop. Is that like, I'm just kidding.
Funny story though, I was the rapper for this wedding band. I forget if I've ever told you this. We would go out, it was a 15 musician ensemble, 11 instrumentalists and 4 vocalists. And it was generally white guy, white girl, black girl. And the black guy in our group was at that point in his 40s. So soul singer, R&B singer, legitimately one of the most talented people I've ever been around, could not rap his way out of a wet paper bag.
So young white Dave DVDL had to be the rapper?
I was doing Jay-Z in the grand ballroom of the Bellagio on New Year's Eve because Mike Avery couldn't rap. Oh yeah.
Interesting. You've seen the Wedding Singer?
I have, not in a long time.
Wasn't the granny at the end going like a hip hop, hippie to the hip hip hop? Is that you?
I did not play the grandmother in The Wedding Singer, if that's what you're asking,
no,
Jamie.
I was asking if like that was the parallel. Like that's the dichotomy of like, yeah, you see like Granny rapping, like, oh my God, that's crazy. Like was seeing young DVDL rapping Jay-Z, was that like, what the heck is going on here?
I think I was marginally more credible than that, but probably not appreciably so. I did do at least once Kanye's Gold Digger at a wedding at the request of the bride.
Did you do the, I'm assuming you did the double broke edited version.
We really did not get into many racial epithets on stage at these various and sundry high-end weddings.
All right. I'm going to see here. Let me see. I'm going to go best karaoke song so I can see if I can pick one. Oh, this one jumps out. Alejandro by Lady Gaga.
Know that song, Jamie. I'm a 44 right. year old man.
Just testing it here. I'm not gonna let you give me an answer yet. Alejandro, they're staying alive. That's too hackney. What
it's
about
a high for the baritone, too?
What about Journey? What's that song? It's not on here, but just a small town girl. That one. What's that song?
You want me to do Don't Stop Believing?
I don't know. What's your go-to? And then I'll see if I approve.
I'm more of an American Songbook kind of Sinatra-y guy. If you want me to do rock and roll, I'll do
let's
rock
go Buble. No, let's go Buble. Let's do Feeling Good.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Something in the sky, you know how I feel. What? Now there's a third line, you know how I feel. It's a new day, it's a new dawn, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good.
Oh, there's the bass coming in. Boom, ba-da.
Hold on.
David, I've never heard you sing. I've never asked you to sing before.
Well, I'm always happy to do it. I will. I'll try to get more public performances within the GoBundance realm, I guess.
That was awesome. Thank you. That just made my day, man. I could turn this thing off now and say, what a great Friday this has been. So, oh man. All right. One more time. Where do people find you? What do you want to leave them with? All of that. What's websites or social media handles? Drop them.
Yeah, absolutely. So on a professional level, if you like me, wait until you get to know my wife. NourishHouseCalls.com, we mentioned before. We're getting more and more active, looking to be even better and better at Facebook and Instagram. That's kind of where our patient population spends their most time. So it's just Nourish House Calls on both of those platforms. On a personal level, if you've listened this long to this episode of this podcast, you're probably someone I want to get to know. So reach out to me personally. My cell is 630-863-5239. If you're curious, yes, that is 630-TOE-LADY, something I figured out 20 years ago and I'm very proud of. And my email address is davevdl72@gmail.com. You want to talk about anything from literature to trademark law to functional medicine to music. I'm happy to chat.
I love it, man. Incredible. Did you want to ask your questions before we go?
Oh, yes, absolutely. So one of the things I loved from your interview with Ben Hardy, and thank you for the reminder, is Ben turned the camera around on you a little bit and said, hey, what did you get from this interview? What are your takeaways? Yeah. So I'm curious because basically I'm the Ben Hardy of this conversation. So what were your what are your takeaways from what we talked about today?
The first one is it's funny. You go down this rabbit hole of you talk about your lawyer career. In my brain, it's like, man, he is not recognizing that success in music would be something different. And I had that whole challenge to you or whatever. And I give you credit. I can see why you're a good lawyer, but it did like shift my mind when you said, you know, making money does not equal fulfillment in that particular thing. So in other words, when you made the point that look, I get the music in my life that makes me feel great. It doesn't mean it has to be tied to money. I was accusing you of tying it to money, not in a good way, like being limited with your mindset around money on this particular thing, when really it was me that was being limiting in myself in terms of a money mindset, because it made me think of my brand in particular. Let's go with Instagram. It's exploded. It's absolutely gone wild lately as we record this. And it's fun. it's fun interacting with people. It's fun coming up with, you know, new thoughts, things I could share, you know, showing the country, whatever that I do on my Instagram account. And it's a reminder, right? Like, yeah, look, you know, these all lead down the paths of monetization at a certain point. There's an avenue there and all of that, but it's just fun. Just have fun. Enjoy what you're doing, right? It doesn't have to be about the money. So that was takeaway number one. The second takeaway was the reminder on 6 summers left. For some reason, anytime somebody says that number, whatever it is, 4, 8, 12, 6, 5, the summers left thing always resonates with me. So it's that reminder, like, you know what? We just passed another one. I got an 8 and 5 year old. I'm down to 10. This is my last double digit year of summers, right? Like there's 10 left and that's it. So great reminder. And then last, and this is the big one, I think, you mentioned talking to this guy, Blue, I think you said his name is.
Yes.
Blue is your boy.
He's absolutely my boy.
That was my third takeaway.
You should have had me sing Scorpions.
I like Buble. I'm actually a big Buble fan. So I should have had you do a Christmas song since we're in that time frame. But Dave, I appreciate you, brother. Love you. Thanks for doing this.